and Edmund opens the coolant valves in his suit to relieve the burn. Then the bell and they slam together again. It's not until Edmund lands a penalty hit that I guess it. He's already taken his position at reset distance. The bell waits for Cor. And Cor keeps fumbling with his coolant valve.
Let's go, Cor!
Vicky's shouting. She isn't the only one.
Why won't he reset?
His suit doesn't have coolant.
Doesn't have what?
She's too riveted to attend my answer. Cor fumbles a little longer, and then his shoulders settle. He's realised the ruse, too. This wasn't ever meant to be a fair fight. After languishing in a cell, in fear, with this one hope on the horizon, it's going to be taken from him. I see the realization in his sagging shoulders. He assumes position, but now he's hunching close to his dragon, stiff in the saddle. The penalty hit got his right side and dominant arm. He grips the reins with his left hand because it's the only one he can still use. I only realize I've lifted my fingers to cover my face when Vera tugs at them.
He'll be okay. It's only a tournament, Abby.
But by the end, even she's crying. The roast is slow. Unable to relieve the pain, Cor curls closer and closer to his dragon's back. He manages to get another penalty hit on Edmund, but Edmund's coolant works just fine, and he recovers as if he didn't feel the burn at all. After Cor takes another penalty, he stops really guiding his dragon at all. Morana takes over, screeching at her rider's anguish, attempting to keep him safe from the blasts. But eventually she tires. For the final blow, though it need only be a penalty hit, Edmund's dragon performs a full heat blast that blankets them. What's called a kill shot. They have to carry Cor off his dragon.
Do you think he'll be all right?
Vera asks as she rubs Vicky's back.
Dosed hits aren't fatal, I say, if he receives medical attention.
If. A terrible thought grips me. What if they want it to be fatal?
I had only thought,
Vicky says, wiping her eyes,
that he'd be good enough. But I suppose that new one is dragonborn.
I turn to look at her.
You think that's why Cor lost?
Vicky lifts a shoulder, looking ashamed and bewildered.
Cor lost to Leo last time, didn't he?
In semi-finals for the First Rider tournament, when I beat Power, Cor was the one Lee eliminated to become a finalist. Kallipolans now know, as they didn't then, Lee's parentage. Ixion steps forward.
People of Kallipolis, he says, you asked for democratic reforms, so now I give them to you. You have seen the outcome of this match, but far be it from me to dictate who will fly for your fleet. Today, the choice is yours. Do you give Edmund the laurel for Cortis? Do you give an eye?
My fingers curl into fists on my apron as I understand. It isn't enough to humiliate a lowborn rider in front of the whole city. Ixion will use the apparatus of democracy to ensure it is the people themselves who find him less worthy. I squeeze my eyes shut to block out the sight of the hands lifting into the air in confirmation, but I still hear it. The swelling of the eyes, quiet at first, growing louder, until finally It is a chant that fills the arena, and even Vicky whispers it beside me. I blink burning eyes open. Edmund Haystorm Scourge, Lee's bastard brother, lifts a fist in the air from the palace box where he's landed to receive his laurel from Freyda, his wispy white blonde hair glinting in the sun. A frightened kind of cheering answers his crowning. Lee alone of the Dragonborn seems to have forgotten to clap.
"May I present Edmund Hay Stormscourge," Ixion proclaims, "your new Quartus."
As we exit the arena, I listen to the murmurs from others, like Vicky, who watched their champion lose. Maybe the next guardian will make his slot, someone says. But I already know that's a fool's hope. Ixion will drive any lingering doubt about Dragonborn supremacy into the ground. One sabotaged flame suit at a time. I follow numb steps back into the palace, and then, remembering my duty to serve Freyda's coffee, I take off for her apartments at a jog.
Lee. I'm prepared to raise the roof if they don't let me see Kor, but Ixion seems to think it's funnier to allow it. I find him on a stretcher, in a covered cart, on his way out of the cloister courtyard to the nearest side gate in the outer walls. They intend to return him to the vault. He smells of burns. Kor!
Lee!
The helmet protected most of his face, but even here the lines of skin rippling, bubbling, are visible. No physician has been called. The men in charge of the cart are military. Kor's eyes close after they find me. I have no boot knife myself, so I turn to his guard. Cut him out of his flame suit! My lord, we have orders to take him directly. I hold eye contact, and the soldier, who recognizes me, loses nerve. At any rate, my status as both Dragonborn and Guardian leaves my rank in the chain of command negotiable. I have cold water sent for, rags, and whatever ointments that can be found, coolant or aloe, or, that failing, honey from the kitchens. I have to hope that after he's returned to his cell in the vault, no one follows up to make sure he died from this. What care I can give him now will have to be enough. I'm siphoning cold water over the worst of the burns along his side, sopping up pus-soiled water with a rag, when he finally croaks words out.
"Really thought we had that one in the bag."
I motion for another bucket of cold water. "It was my fault. I told Ixion to give you a chance." Kor laughs hoarsely.
"I'm flattered by your faith in me."
When I've done everything I can think of, Kor grips my hand with his raw red one.
"Don't let them hurt Morana."
As they roll him away, I wonder whether I'll ever see him again. I'm almost back to the cloister before I remember I don't live there anymore. I rotate on my heel and make my way to what once was and now is again the Stormscourge entrance to the inner palace. In the time it's taken me to tend Kor, the bastards have made themselves at home in my family's restored apartments. I find Edmund, still wearing the laurel, lounging in the parlour on what was once my mother's favourite settee, since reupholstered. The bastards surround him, toasting his name. His storm scourge envy spreads ash across the freshly laundered rug. Edmund glances at the pus on my hands and the ash on my arms when I enter.
"You look like shit."
I lunge for him. "You cheating coward!" I don't get halfway across the room before the other bastards restrain me. And then Envy lifts his head and hisses. Ash stings my eyes and chokes my breath. As I cough, Titus and Angelo force me to my knees.
"He's the cheat," Edmund says coolly. "I've got no obligation to play fair against a commoner who stole one of my family's dragons."
The hypocrisy of this makes me burst out laughing as my eyes stream. Your mother was a commoner. She must have been. Edmund is built too much like a Highland peasant for her to have been anyone else. It fits my father's profile, a considerate father, a loving husband, the sort of man who'd never be unfaithful to his wife with anyone he considered her equal. It would have been an abuse of power, the kind he never thought about afterward except to pay the father for the inconvenience of a ruined, pregnant daughter. Edmund hears the appeal to his decency as an insult. His dragon's fangs bare, and its hackles rise. Edmund gets to his feet.
Yeah, and apparently you share our father's proclivity for serfs. Get him out of my sight!
Titus and Angelo throw me from the drawing room. Outside, a valet scurries to my side, helps me to my feet, and brushes off my sooty uniform. I miss his name completely and hear hardly a word of his nervous chatter as he leads me down the corridor. I come to my senses when he directs me into a bedchamber I have not set foot in since I was 8.
Lord Edmund claimed the master suite, so we've prepared the room that was yours before, my lord.
The bed, which was child size, has been replaced with an adult frame. The door that led into my nurse's chambers has been shut. The curtains and the bedclothes have been replaced, though they still have the heather embroidery, now also embellished with black clovers. The painting over the mantle is the same, a clutch of storm scourge eggs, with a single slitted eye peering out, the first one cracking. I used to bob my head to create the illusion it was moving. I turn to the valet and realize for the first time that I know him.
Bart, you worked at the Lyceum Club.
Bart bows.
Aye, my lord, but before that I served like this.
His lined face betrays no emotions, though I wonder how he survived one regime to another, and what he saw or did. Some of the household turned on their lords. Others were punished for serving them in the first place.
My lord, Her Divine Highness sends this with her regards.
He holds out Palor's summoner. It's been snapped free from the guardian wristband that once contained it, and is strung on a chain as my father's once was. The arched window that looks out over the balcony and the firemouth has been cracked to let in a chill breeze that battles with the flaming hearth. One day, Leo, a dragon of your own will be yours to summon from this perch. Stinking of Kor's pain, numb with my failure, I suddenly crave Palor's presence so strongly that even the misgiving of my father's memory isn't enough to stop me. I take 2 steps to the glass door, throw it open, and lean over the balcony. The whistle sounds a blast, too high for human ears to hear, into the firemouth looming below. I don't have long to wonder if Palor can hear it. Within a minute, he emerges from the caves, spiraling on an updraft, to land lightly on the dragon perch of my childhood bedchamber. I lean against him, inhaling the familiar smell of his ash. He's been scrubbed down by a keeper, his saddle removed. Inside, I find Bart waiting stiffly on the side of the room farthest from the dragon perch.
The princess also invites you to coffee, if you are available before the feast.
One look down makes me realize how unfit I am for polite society in this state.
I don't think I'm... I've prepared a basin for your ablutions, and can be of assistance.
I'll do it myself.
I insist, my lord,
Bart says. He sounds like the servants I remember, proficient in his dragon tongue, with just a hint of the lower bank stopping his words, roughening them. I look at him, and though he flinches, he doesn't back down. Ordered, perhaps, by someone who outranks me, Ixion or Freda. I can feel tiredness sinking into my bones. I reek of ash, of the smell of burned flesh. And on the edge of my mind, the thought that Kor's burns were my fault sits waiting. After everything else that's happened, resisting the motions of aristocratic toilette feels like dying on a molehill. I ease into the nearest chair, and Bart rolls over the basin of warm water.
That's it, my lord.
I let him wash me. And though there are reasons why it should feel strange to let a servant tend to me like this, to have Palor just outside basking in the sunlight of a dragon perch from the life before, there are reasons why it feels right, too. And I'm too tired to fight the feeling of its rightness. Shadows have lengthened on the walls of the inner palace, glowing warm and golden in the winter afternoon light, when Bart finishes toweling my hair dry. Only when I reach down to unclasp my flame suit, do I remember the letter tucked inside it from Dora Mithridates. I open it, and the words swim before my eyes. It's a deed to a Highland estate registered to Dora's name. A small sketch of the house and its floor plan leave no doubt which it is. I read the listed assets numbly. Stripped of its feudal landholding, the property is reduced to the manor and its immediately surrounding acres of vineyards, orchards, and thermal springs for dragon hatching. A single groundskeeper and dog come with the property. Dora's purchase receipt is dated to a post-revolutionary auction. A codicil to the deed stipulates that upon the death of its owner, the estate should return to its original heir, Leo Stormscourge. Clipped to the rider in what must be Dora's spindly hand is a note. You remember when I once told you we had more to discuss than a tapestry? This was it. Bart speaks, and he has to say it twice for me to hear him. He's asked if I'll be visiting Freda the old-fashioned way. I thumb my eyes dry before I answer. I might as well. Dora Mithridates was no nonsense to the end, and I think she'd want me to be too. Bart nods. Then I'll prepare him, my lord. The old-fashioned way means by dragonback. Bart removes a small court saddle from its mount by the balcony door. Little more than a thick rug, it's used for traversing the inner palace via the firemouth. It seems that dragon keeping, too, is a skill set Bart claims with traditional competence. He approaches Palor with a jerking bow. Palor's tail flicks. He eyes Bart coolly and then lowers his head in return. Bart lays the court saddle over his haunches. That will do, my lord and dragon. She's in the Aurelian wing. It's the first time I've heard the apartments that became the offices of the first protector so named in a decade. In the rose parlour? Indeed, my lord. I mount Palor and we hop into the air of the firemouth. The windows and dragon perches of the inner palace spin around us, some of them dark, others glowing as the evening lamps are lit. For a moment, the memories layer over again. My father on dragonback, making his way from one social hour to another in a firemouth bustling with the transit of dragon lords. Years later, poised like this with Annie, I located Atreus's office from memories of the old regime when we first reported the sighting of a Pythian fleet. That's the memory that feels distant, right now, and the memory of my father close enough to touch. Palor and I cross the firemouth in the long light and land on the perch outside Freda's apartments. The Rose Parlour is where Atreus entertained dignitaries and high-ranking officials. Before that, it was Arcturus Aurelian's most intimate receiving room. It's been refurbished in the traditional style and is brightly lit. Inside, Freda is visible, sitting alone at her sofa, as a maid strains the coffee. And when we land, she looks up and her smile shows through the rippled glass. I dismount Palor and go to the glass door, which the maid opens. Freda has risen to her feet. A smile transforms her face, melting its coldness and crinkling her eyes with warmth. I see you got your summoner.
I did, thank you. I hope you don't mind that I brought Palor along.
Not at all, Freda says. I had heard this was a tradition of your court.
It is clever. But surely your great Goliathans must make a court far grander, I answer, as the maid takes my mantle.
Perhaps where size makes for grander courts, cleverness is encouraged by fleets of great number.
I feel like we are tossing a ball back and forth, in a way I haven't done in years, but it comes so easily I hardly know what I say. Between the return to my family's old apartments, Palor's summoner in my hand, and the profound sense of futility left after Kor's match, it's as though I've been unlocked. What comes out is court banter. I'm done fighting this. And now with your great dragon and our numerous fleet, our court will be both grand and clever. Freda lets out a tinkling laugh. The maid approaches with the coffee service.
I am sorry for what happened to your friend today.
Freda's tone sobers as she receives her coffee. The cups are half as large as Kallipolan teacups, and the steaming Basilean coffee, even strained, looks mud-like.
I had my suspicions, but hoped they would be wrong. Do you know if he...
He'll be fine, thank you. Her sympathy is as unwanted as her mention of Kor. After going to the effort of scrubbing the day's failure off me, I have no interest in being reminded of it. Coffee, even the Basilean variety, isn't strong enough. Freda nods. She drums her fingers lightly on the table and lifts the tiny cup to her lips.
And my proposal? Have you given it more thought today?
How could I not?
I was hoping that might be the case.
Please, she adds with a hint of impatience, snapping the maid forward to fill my cup, because she's been standing frozen by my chair. The maid steps forward, bends to pour my coffee and sloshes it. I glance at her. It's Annie.
17. A political arrangement. Annie. I should have seen this coming. Freda having a guest for coffee. How many possible options could there be? How did it not occur to me that working as a parlourmaid for Freda Basileon would put me in the presence of not just the princess, but of the rest of the court? Of Lee? My stomach goes into my mouth at the sight of Palor silhouetted in the glass. Even though reconnecting with the Guardians is what I've been working towards since I returned, this isn't how I want to do it. I don't want Lee to recognize me in front of Freda, dressed up like a maid serving coffee in a stupid cap and frock. But when he doesn't so much as notice me, that's 100 times worse. It's not that I wanted to find him miserable and distressed after weeks locked away with the family he betrayed, but instead to find him carefree, happy and flirting? And discussing a proposal. It doesn't take genius to guess what kind. If I were Freda, I wouldn't want to marry Ixion either. He's speaking in a way I've never heard before, jaunty, bantering, his dragon tongue mellifluous and luxuriant. At ease and pleased with himself, handsome and conscious of it, an ankle propped across a knee, fingers idly tracing the embroidery of the chair he lounges in. When Freda snaps her fingers, I come to my senses. He doesn't so much as look at me, even as I approach his chair with the coffee pot. How do I look? Like someone I was taught to ignore. It's less charming now. I could touch that hair. I could slap that face. I could tear this maid's cap off and hit him with it. Only when my shaking fingers lift the spout of the pot too jerkily and a bit of coffee splatters on the tiny saucer does Lee glance up. His expression vaguely bored, a little curious, as if a servant's mistake doesn't bother or interest him, but does slightly surprise him. And then our eyes meet. This is the moment I'd been anticipating and dreading in equal measure since I embarked on this fool's mission of infiltrating the Clover Restoration. I had not anticipated it happening in front of Freda Basileon. But Lee has had many years of practicing a straight face.
After the flash of recognition, his expression smooths. Exactly the way I've seen it do in classes for the last 10 years when teachers talked about Palace Day and Lee pretended to be no one and feel nothing. "I'm sorry," says Freda in dragon tongue. "The staff is still in training. Much of my household had to be left in Vask." Evidently, she attributed our pause to the spilled coffee. Her gaze has narrowed as she looks not at me, but at Lee. As if she were using this moment of perturbation to evaluate him. Lee smiles at her, a flash of white teeth. I feel a swoop in my stomach at the sight. We still stand close enough to touch. "Oh, don't apologize," he tells Freda, waving a hand. "You're fine." He adds to me, in a courteous and slightly disinterested Kalish, "What do they call you?" It's precisely the tone his father used speaking to villagers of Holbin during collections. I'm so flustered, I seize upon the familiar script as well. It's not ill-suited to giving Lee the information he needs. "Abigail, my lord," I answer, balancing the pot as I curtsy. Lee's still smiling, but he blinks at the curtsy. "Pleasure to meet you, Abigail. Is that a Highland accent I hear?" "Yes, my lord. I'm from Thornham." Lee lifts his cup to toast me. "To Abigail of Thornham," he murmurs, "from the Highlands." A blush creeps up my neck as I curtsy again and remove myself to the doorway. From this vantage point, I can easily observe Freda, studying Lee over the lip of her cup with a small measure of appreciation, and Lee, oddly pale in the face as he turns back to her with his brightest smile. "Where were we?" he says, with a gesture as if to wave away everything in the room but Freda. But where they were, neither has a chance to recall. The door to the parlour is opened by Betsuna, her nose in the air. "Your Divine Highness has a second visitor for coffee." Freda twists, her mouth puckering. "Betsuna, I told you I would be undisturbed." Betsuna lifts a significant brow. Ixion steps around her, grinning jauntily. "My Lord Ixion," says Freda. Lee has stiffened. "I didn't realize you wished to be undisturbed with Cousin Leo," says Ixion, with a curious glance between Freda and Lee. "Not at all," says Freda. "In truth, we were discussing your upcoming triumph." Ixion's strange smile relaxes. "You don't want me to help plan it?" "One should never have to plan one's own party," says Freda. Ixion moves to kiss Freda, and the princess, smiling, turns her head so that the kiss lands on her cheek. "My betrothed is so bashful," he tells Lee, with a show of humour that sounds strained. "When will this betrothal be announced?" Lee asks, his brows together as he watches the two of them. Freda says, "We were thinking at the triumph. It would be good to have everything tied up in time for the next League summit." She must mean the Medean League. The talk of the spring summit will, without a doubt, be Basilia's expansion into Kallipolis, and it would help Freda's case if she achieves legitimacy before then. Amid all else, I find myself impressed with her head for strategy. Ixion tosses himself into the chair beside Lee. "Quite a disappointment from your Highmarket friend." Lee's lips form a line. "I'm thinking I'll save all the defeated guardians for the triumph. I'd like a procession of them as tributes. And then, maybe, a sacrifice, or they can be handed out as prizes. I haven't decided yet. The dragons, naturally, will be disposed of once they breed. Lee's back is rigid, his knuckles white on his saucer. Freda clears her throat. I hear the dragonborn from New Pythos have arrived safely on the river barges and will be attending tonight's feast. Ixion ignores her attempt at a change of subject. Ideally, we'd have the first rider captured by then. Prize of honor. Parsifal says he has a lead, so perhaps he'll deliver in time. He twists in his chair and stares directly at me. Are you just going to stand there? He asks in Kalish. My hands shaking again, I take a step forward. Lee squints down at his coffee. Freda studies Ixion with a line forming above her brow. I pour with the distinct feeling that Ixion is eyeing me. Is he staring because I look familiar? We've seen each other face to face, helmets off, exactly once before on Wayfarer's Arch, when I returned Julia's body. But it was at a distance. After Gorin's failure to recognize me at the interview, I felt confident gambling Ixion wouldn't either. Now I wonder whether I misjudged. Is this the Nearhall, Serf? Ixion asks Freda. She is my parlour maid, Freda answers curtly. Ixion laughs. Right, he says. But she's still, you know, mine. He glances over at Lee with a lifted brow, as if to include him in a joke that he doesn't expect Freda to appreciate. But Lee's jaw only twitches. Ixion heaves a sigh. No one around here has a sense of humour. What's your name? He asks me in Kalish. My face has begun to burn with a muddle of shame and fury. For a moment, the panicked thought occurs that the blush will give away my understanding of their dragon tongue, but it seems Ixion's tone is suggestive enough that no one questions my discomfort. Lee's face is now as white as the china cup he holds, which rests still in his frozen hand. Freda gets to her feet. Please excuse us, she tells Lee, then snaps her fingers at Ixion as she did at me a moment earlier. Ixion rises, smirking like a student who's been caught at mischief by an overbearing teacher, and follows Freda out of the room with a wink at me as he passes. I'm shorter than either of them by a head. Freda closes the door behind them, but it only muffles the severity of her lowered voice. Lee remains sitting with his back turned, staring at the cup in his hands. I do not move from my position by the door. A pulse pounds in my ears and heats my face. What are you doing here? He asks. I was trying to... My voice is faint, laughter at my own idiocy breaking it. Rescue you. Lee stares into the dregs of his coffee. Then he lifts the cup to his lips, drains it, and sets the empty cup on the table in front of him. It takes me a moment to understand. I reach for the coffee pot and cross the room. As I refill his cup, Lee's fingers take those of my free hand, which is shaking, and press them in his. The pressure of his hand on mine makes my knees go weak. I want to crawl into his arms. I want him to take me miles away from this nightmare, from those monsters on the other side of the door. Or maybe just one monster. Surrounded by so many worse alternatives, I can find little fault with Freda. Even if I suspect her argument with Ixion is more about her own honour than her staff's. Given a choice between despots, I'd rather have one who admires a peasant's pluck and stands up for her maids than one who doesn't. The cup fills too quickly.
Too soon, Lee releases my hand, and I back away from him. You should do it, I tell him as I arrange the tray of honey biscuits. His back is still turned. He has not looked at me once since we were left alone. I think if he does, it will undo me. Do what? My vision burns, and I stare down at the biscuits, counting breaths. Marry her. Annie, he says at once. I'm not saying it out of spite. I mean, my feelings aside, it would be good for Callipolis, far better than Ixion. If we're going to bear the Basileian yoke either way. Annie, I don't love her. Outside in the corridor, Ixion's voice cuts off Freda's, writ with sarcasm. For a moment, I let the word love wrap around me like an embrace, feeling its warmth release the tension in every muscle in my body. Then I set that aside. That's not what these kind of marriages are about. Will you? Lee finally turns his head to glare at me. Stop thinking like a guardian for 1 minute. I glare back at him. But even this can't be sustained. His gaze softens. You changed your hair, he murmurs. I did. And you liberated New Pythos. Well, I helped. Lee's lips curve in a smile, and I feel a faltering smile hitch itself back on my face. For a breath, it's enough to forget Ixion, that imbecile, to forget this city and my many failures. I've found Lee again, and his smile is every bit as beautiful as I remember it. But that's not enough. If Freda makes a gambit to establish you as her partner rather than Ixion, she'll need to do it publicly, probably at the Triumph, which could be my opportunity to move if he's got the conquered guardians in the procession. Lee hesitates, as if he isn't sure he wants to tell me what he says next. She's suggested making a deal with her. Your hand for the guardians. He nods. Well, that's perfect. This is an opportunity, and it should not be squandered. Whatever my heart says. But Lee shakes his head bleakly. It wouldn't free the dragons, Annie, so long as Ixion has them. He's got a direct line to every guardian's nerve center, even if he doesn't have them in his prison. But for the first time in a long time, I'm smiling. Lee's just cut my job in half. That's fine. You take care of the guardians, and I'll take care of the dragons. We have a time, a place, a chance. Ayla and I will figure out the rest.
Lee. I attend the evening's feast in a daze. I haven't been in the Hall of Plenty since the Lycian Ball, and after a winter of famine, the bounty provided to welcome the Dragonborn feels obscene. But it seems Freda's allowance from Basilia has been sufficient to resupply our stores, or at least it is for the time being. Someone found a pig to roast, in whose mouth could be stuffed an apple. I sit at Ixion's left, across from Freda, at the head of the table. Farther down, Lotus and Power sit among the clover riders. In my father's time, the dragons of honored guests were invited to lounge along the skirts of the hall, which means that tonight, Palor glints in the shadow of the columns, curled at an uneasy distance from Nita. Freda's Goliathan, as large as one of the palace courtyards alone, remains roosting atop Pytho's keep. Rock serves at our table. Annie is nowhere to be seen. But the reunion with her earlier and the prospect of Freda's proposal seem to cancel each other out. One reality cannot be true without the other. Can Annie really have suggested such a thing, accepting this? One second she spoke of rescuing me, the next of making this my final future. Letting a servant wash me, bantering with a princess, barely glancing twice at the maid who takes my coat. I feel like I'm succumbing to the decadence of my father, like a slowly boiling frog. I can run and run and run, and still the blood catches up with me. I don't want this to be how I lose Annie for good. Will you climb, Atreus asked, and hope your light shines brightly enough to light the way for others? Would it be selfish not to? After dinner, I extend a hand to Freda Basileon after she has opened the first dance with Ixion. The Medean waltz, the same that I once danced with Annie, turns us on the flagstones of the cleared hall. Freda's waist is narrow and warm in my hand, her button nose a shadow beneath a sheer veil. She is, I notice perhaps for the first time, and without enthusiasm, pretty. We could make this work. Eventually I might even forget the girl I love, and find a kind of happiness with this one, for whom I have growing respect. And one day I might even talk her into resuming the revolutionary reforms that Ixion has been so keen to discontinue. I could do good with this. I speak in her ear. I want pardons for every single one of the guardians. Freda's smile is visible through her veil. That can be arranged. I want their safe passage ensured to Norcia. My fingers are shaking so badly as I hold her waist, Freda shifts in my grip. Of course, she says. She presses her lips together, studying the room at the turn. Some watch us, but none can hear. We'll announce the engagement at the Triumph. Until then, we'll need to be discreet. How do I reach you? The answer is obvious, even if giving it has the feeling of stepping into my own grave. Send messages through the girl. Freda doesn't ask which one.
Annie. I lie awake the night of the long-awaited return, with my stomach twisting. I'm quartered in the lower levels of Freda's wing of the inner palace, across a courtyard from the Hall of Plenty, and the sounds of revelry vibrate through the stone. I can just make out the high notes of their violins. The dragonborn are feasting, and their parlour maids are not required. I'm free to stew in my own thoughts. I've found Lee at last, and I face losing him permanently. Every way I look at it, it's the best way. If Freda's here to stay, let her share her rule with one worthy of it. If I'm to free the conquered guardians, let me do it with the least bloodshed. If Ixion is to have his restoration, let him be outsmarted. All these calculations add up to one solution. And yet, it feels that my aching heart outweighs them all. It takes me an hour to realize the writhing of my stomach. The insistent turbulence is not mine alone. I'm feeling Ayla. She's so distant, her feelings are barely a pulse, a whisper almost out of earshot. But as I still myself, quieting my own thoughts, hers come free like shells revealed by a tide. She's not alone. She's with a mother of pearl sheen of scales, golden hair. I sit bolt upright. I know my way to the cloister courtyard so well that I can find it in the dark. Inside, I shuffle into what was my old dorm room, where Vera still sleeps with the other keepers in training. I shake her awake, and in the hallway outside, I make a hasty excuse. Richard Nearholserf really misses his dragon. I was hoping to go give it an apple. Vera inhales with excitement. We knew you two had a thing. But I don't think dragons eat apples, Abby. She sounds like she's not 100% certain about this.
Please, Vera. I know where he's stabled and everything.
Young love wins. She lends me her key to the armory. Inside, I swap my slippers for a keeper's cave boots and throw a protective leather mantle over my shoulders. This close to her, I can feel Ayla's mind tethering mine like a cable wire. I make my way through the next door, down the stairs, and into the caves with a lantern tapered low. Another night, I'll need to map out exactly where our dragons are and theirs. But tonight, I only need to follow the connection to Ayla without blowing my cover. The keeper's gear will smell familiar to the dragons, and between that and a soft tread, I wend deeper without incident. I hear deep, slow breathing and smell sulfur. But no dragon stirs from sleep. The line of our connection clarifies the deeper down I go. Pretty soon, I've left the known networks of caves and am making my way out of the palace entirely, into tunnels that lead to the city sewers in one direction, the drainage systems of Pytho's keep in the other. I make my way along the main tunnel that burrows under Pytho's keep. After what must be an hour, when my toes have grown cold and damp in the keeper's boots, I find myself staring up at a grating that crisscrosses the deep blue of a night sky beyond. Silhouetted on the other side waits Ayla. She snorts with pleasure as I reach through the partition to lay a hand on her snout. Annie? A second dragon's head rears beside Ayla's, this one slenderer and paler, and beside her stands Chryssa. Chryssa reaches through the grating to take my hand. Her blonde hair is silver in the moonlight, filtering through cypress boughs. Hang on, Chryssa says, reaching for the deadbolt holding the metal partition shut. She twists, and it snaps off like a dead branch. Didn't want to risk dragonfire drawing unwanted attention, she says, holding up a hacksaw. We've been working on that all evening. I swing the grating open. Chryssa pulls me up and over the threshold, embraces me, and Ayla's forehead nudges mine, her crest flattening. She's purring. Come on, Chryssa says. They're waiting for us. At the foot of Paran's Spring, looking out over the moonlit river and the spires of the Island of the Dead, sit a ring of dragons and their riders. My guardians. Annie! I'm blinking around at them as my eyes adjust. What are you? Where did you? Not all of us were in the cloister the day of the coup, says Alexa, smiling. As I warm myself by the spring, they share how they escaped the coup. Some were on patrol, some were in the palace infirmary, recovering from injuries sustained in the airstrikes, and snuck out when they realized something was wrong. Chryssa, on her mission with another skyfish rider named Warren, found them one by one when she returned from Deimos, after she saw the changed flags on the ramparts. And then, when Ayla found us and led us here, you know the rest. The feeling of being surrounded by so many familiar faces, as friendly and relieved by the sight of me as I am by them, warms me as much as the steam off the hot spring. The quiet night, the whispering cypresses seem to curl around us as if Pytho's keep and the river herself protect us. Of course, now that I'm surrounded by them, it occurs to me that I myself should have tracked down the guardians still at large when I got back. Chryssa acted as a commander should have. My first impulse was to put on an apron and apply for a job as a maid. And you? Chryssa asks. What have you been doing in the palace? Scrubbing floors. I've been undercover. I made contact with Rock and Lee. Oh, says Chryssa warmly.
Well done! How?
I find I don't want to tell her exactly how. They were hiring new staff. I took a job. Chryssa makes a noise of appreciation at this contrivance, but there is a pause as she studies me, where I'm pretty sure she's able to figure out what kind of uniform I'm wearing.
Well, that's great, Annie, she says. I saw that challenge Ixion put out. I'm glad you didn't fall for it.
Her tone is light, encouraging, a bit of a squadron leader voice. But underneath, I can hear her hesitation. What I can't tell is why. Because she thinks I've messed up? Or because she can sense the shame that I feel radiating from my own face in the dark? Why am I so ashamed? Yeah, well, that was a trap. Obviously, Chryssa shudders. We all saw what happened to Kor. Chryssa and Kor were always close. Lee's in a circle. And I realize that whatever she saw of the tournament today must have been even more excruciating for her than it was for me. He's fine. They're saving him for the triumph. Chryssa lets out a slow breath. And Lee? He's courting Freyda.
What?
Chryssa's squadron leader tone vanishes with her squawk of indignation. He's going to negotiate a pardon of the Guardians as a part of the engagement. I just have to let the dragons out. We're thinking at the triumph.
Annie?
What? Alexa giggles. I can see Chryssa's eye roll in the moonlight.
Sometimes you terrify me.
I feel a certain exasperation, tinged with fondness, as I understand. Chryssa and I have our own history of romantic rivalry, and I appreciate her skepticism about a new arrival. But really? In the middle of a counter-revolution, with friends in danger, she wants me to prioritize my feelings. Political marriages aren't romantic. Chryssa throws up her hands.
So what? He marries this princess, we retreat to Norcia, and that's it?
I'm not sure what she's getting at. Yeah, that's it. What else is there? Chryssa exhales through her nose.
I don't know. Revolt?
For a second, I think she's joking. Then I realize she's staring at me wide-eyed, as are the rest of the Guardians. I think I just snorted.
I'm serious, Chryssa says. The Basileans haven't taken the southern coast yet. With enough rogue Guardians and a good jailbreak of dragons, we could stage a resistance from Harbour Town. I've got friends in the garrison there. Deimos wasn't interested in offering food aid to Kallipolis. They've got a new administration that's on an isolationist streak. But with Basilia's occupation, I'm willing to bet they'd pay attention now. The scale of what she suggests is dizzying. Another Basilean war. Haven't we read enough about the carnage the first two wrought? The Basilean occupation was voted in by a legitimate assembly, Chryssa. Which was stupid, Alexa protests. No one's denying that. If you lead the resistance, you'd lend us legitimacy, Chryssa insists. First Rider, commander of the aerial fleet. And if we got Lee, we'd have the protector designate too. Against what? A half-vacant triarchy and a foreign princess? We could push them out of the capital. Until Freyda's Goliathan lays waste to the Ferrish Plain with half a breath and her reinforcements arrive from Varsk, she has an empire at her back. The other riders are watching our argument like it's an exchange of dragonfire. Chryssa says, if we could get Deimos to turn up, so would we.
Ayla's hackles are rising as I lose my temper, but none of them can see her in the dark. And turn this into a proxy war. Our citizens dying, our villagers turned to battlefields, so two empires can play capture the flag over our dead? How would that be better? Alexa speaks up, her voice hardening. Anything's better than vassalage to the Dragonborn. Really? Alexa, from her cushy house on the Janiculum, wants to lecture me on what it's like to bear the yoke? I round on her. You speaking from personal authority on that point, Alexa? Ayla lets out a growl. Alexa takes a quick step backward. Somebody lets out a nervous titter at my comeback that sounds bird-like in the dark. I have the suspicion Chris is eyeing my clothes again, and I want to snap, "What are you looking at?" But when her skyfish whimpers, she loosens her folded arms to place a gentle palm on Phaedra's glimmering side. Her voice is clipped with exhaustion. Annie's right. Deimos can't save us. And this isn't a war we can undertake until it's one we know how to win. She still doesn't quite see it. If Lee has Freyda's ear, we won't need a war at all. For a moment after I say it, the only sound is Paron's spring burbling in the dark. All at once, I hear myself. I remember Leon meeting my eyes. You'll tell your father's friends down in the village, a hand stroking my hair so gently as he said it. When you try to defy us, we take everything. Same old message. And I'm still delivering it, just like Leon wanted me to. Either way, I say, my throat tight, Ayla's muzzle against my curled palm. We've got to get the Guardians out. Chris is nodding. Tell us what you need.
18. Ixion's triumph. Dilo, Nausea. After his first drunk visit, Griff comes by again. He talks about Julia. He talks about Aga. And sometimes I have trouble keeping track of who is who. When he needs it, I walk him home. We never touch more than that. He continues ignoring me during the day. Why am I putting up with it? I suppose I began to think I deserve what this island gives me. He visits so often that word gets out. And then the rumors start. I first get wind of it in conversation with Shaynan of Clan Kraken, a hero from the Liberation, who oversees harbor transition and is my chief contact for procuring the day's catch to feed the Norgian fleet. Evidently, he takes an interest in my romantic life.
Is it true you're Griff Garson's?
It's an anatomical slur, said in a passive voice that I have to parse to make sense of. There are limits to my Norish. And then a widening vista of new hells present themselves, as I understand. This is a form of targeting I'm not prepared for. Such labels are considered among Dragonborn hickish. We take turns, I tell him, which makes Shaynan laugh, but he still grins at me in a way I don't like. In a way that makes me calculate my size and weight against his. I'm glad when I have the cart filled and can wheel it away from the docks. The next day, Fiona, Roxana's former squire, joins my side as I make my way from one lair to the next with the morning feed. Aside from the greedy snorts of dragons roasting their breakfast, the only other sounds are ducks and Lena's laughter as they prep fish in the workroom at the far end of the corridor. You give it to them like that, you'll lose a hand, Fiona warns. Show me, if you're so good at it. She takes the bucket and turns it, protecting her hand, before emptying fish into a salivating Aurelian's trough. Are they always so insufferable? It takes me a moment to realize she means Duck and Lena, not the dragon's guzzling fish. Lena's snort carries down the corridor. I shrug. Young love, all that. At Fiona's disgusted noise, I smile. Speaking of young love, she passes the pail back to me and catches her breath with a hand to her hip. I hear Griff's been visiting you at night. Seems like the whole island's heard. Still, I'm relieved to hear none of Shayna's salacious curiosity in her voice, and it confirms my guess that the squires knew something about our tryst even before the liberation. I'm worried about him, Fiona says. All the squires are. You mean the Woad Riders? I tease gently. Fiona blushes at her slip, and the burn scar across the side of her face becomes a streak of white. She follows me as I make my way down to the stalls.